just want to thank you all so much for making it to the last panel and to the 2015 Books Brunch, because so much of what we've heard in the past week really comes together in these three wonderful authors who are speaking on the panel today. You don't see the third yet, Dan Wildcat, because he will be with us virtually. Dan was unable to travel to Norman, and so we've been testing the technology this morning, and he is going to appear magically, thanks to Kevin, as our second speaker. So I'm Cynthia Barnett. I'm an independent journalist and author who specializes in water. My most recent book is A Natural and Cultural History of Rain, which weaves together stories from history, you know, our history of drought and storm, sort of as cautionary tales for the climate change ahead. Sterling Evans, Dan Wildcat, and Bruce Johansson all work at that intersection of human and environmental history and its impacts and lessons for people and for the planet, especially here on the Great Plains. I'm going to introduce them separately, and each is going to speak for only 15 minutes so that we'll be able to take your questions. We're going to start with Sterling Evans, a professor of history here at the University of Oklahoma, whose specializations include environmental, agriculture, and American West history. Sterling has edited collections on the history and literature of the Western American-Canadian borderlands and on Native Americans in American history. His books include the forthcoming Damming Sonora, an environmental history of water and agriculture in northwestern Mexico. I've talked to some of you about how much I love to interview environmental historians. I feel like whatever story you're working on, you can often find one of these wonderful environmental historians to talk to about the history of that topic. I'm going to just tell you another little detail about Sterling. He loves the Great Plains, so Sterling, thank you.
This is off now, Daniel. For that introduction, and it's good to be here. It's nice all of you could come to Oklahoma this week, and actually Cynthia should be up here doing this talk more than I do since she's written a book about rain. But I am going to talk about climate change here on the Great Plains, but I want to welcome you to this region, to Oklahoma, definitely, for sure. And this is the region that I love so much that I've lived most of my life in. I'm originally from North Dakota, grad school, MA and PhD were at University of Kansas. My first job was in Alberta, then those 7 years in exile out in Northern California. Glad to get away from there, although it was a good job, good students. And then back to Manitoba for a few years, and then down here to Oklahoma. So up and down the Great Plains is where I love to go. I just got back from a conference in Bismarck. That was a lot of fun. And anybody who thinks that this is a flat region is wrong. Those of you who are from the Great Plains know that's not true. Those of you who need to be proven that even more, I encourage you to drive off the interstates but go north up on US 83, 183, or 283. Go north to south and you'll see nothing but hills. Take a bike if you want to, then you'll really know it's not flat. Or I just did with my truck having engine troubles pulling a trailer, and then you couldn't believe how many hills there were. I couldn't believe. But the thing about that was a bike group went from coast to coast a few years ago, from New York to San Francisco. They claimed when they got to San Francisco, the hardest state to ride across was Kansas. They could not believe those big hills out there west of Salina. And I see a Land Institute t-shirt over here. I'm glad to see that over by Salina. And the Smoky Hills were the longest drags they had going on their bikes across. Sure, they went over the Rockies, but those are more gradual going over the mountains. And Kansas was the surprise for them. Of course, there's flat parts in all those places. Manitoba's pretty flat. Kansas has flat places. Oklahoma has some flat places. But not majority of that is pretty hilly and dispersed. So, but also, welcome to this Weather Center. We're very proud of this here. It's the number one school for meteorology in the entire United States and in some ways the world. Dateline Norman is often the case when you see it on in your own journalism and for news stories, especially about severe weather and storms. So this area of the country then is in this region that is considered semi-arid, the Great Plains, or a semi-arid region. And it's funny about that too, because right here at the National Weather Center a couple weeks ago, we had protesters from the Westboro Baptist Church, Topeka, Kansas, who are, of course, climate change haters. They are not believers in that amongst the, what, teeny 0.3% of Americans that don't believe in climate change now. And I was recently in Bismarck listening to K-Fire Radio and they had good old Rush Limbaugh on. It was always interesting to change channels. Used to be a good music station up there, not now. And Rush Limbaugh was talking about Hurricane Joaquin out on the East Coast and how global climate change believers were mad that it wasn't hitting more inland, that there wouldn't be more deaths, because therefore we would be proven wrong, that it's not as bad as it really is. So therefore we were mad that there weren't more deaths because of Hurricane Joaquin. This is what you're up against as journalists, I know. It's what we're up against as scholars and teaching our students and things like that. All very true. In Oklahoma, we deal with a lot of wind. That's one of the things. I love this map showing the wind going from the west to the east and how it gets progressively worse in terms of where a lot of wind turbine ranch farms are now being used and things. And it goes back to even how other people interpreted wind, especially tornadoes. And the Kiowa people believed in Mankai, which was their story for tornadoes. I want to read you a little bit from Scott Momaday, The Way to Rainy Mountain, and their understanding of the wind and tornadoes in this part of the Southern Plains. This is how it was. Long ago, the Kiowas decided to make a horse. They decided to make it out of clay, and so they began to shape the clay with their hands. Well, the horse began to be, but it was a terrible, terrible thing. It began to writhe, slowly at first, then faster and faster until there was a great commotion everywhere. The wind grew up. You gotta love that. The wind grew up and carried everything away. Great trees were uprooted. The Kiowas were afraid of that awful thing, and they went running about, talking to it. And at last it was calm. Even now, when they see the storm clouds gathering, the Kiowas know what it is, that a strange, wild animal roams on the sky. It has the head of a horse and the tail of a great fish. Lightning comes from its mouth, and the tail, whipping and thrashing on the air, makes the high, hot wind of the tornado. But they speak to it, saying, "Pass over me." They are not afraid of Mankai, for it understands their language. And of course, tornadoes are all we have here. Maybe hurricanes on the East Coast, blizzards elsewhere. But tornadoes, naturally, we get here on the Southern Plains. And as destructive as they can be, especially when they hit urban areas like Moore in 1999 and again in 2013, the destruction is very visible. The wind is also the cause of the one of the reasons that we think of the Dirty 30s, the Great Depression years here on the Plains. And I'm going to come back to that, the Dust Bowl years. And of course, as most of you journalists know, the term Dust Bowl was coined by a journalist. You guys coined good terms. It was a journalist who coined the term Latin America, Manifest Destiny, Dust Bowl. We're all termed by, go out and coin some more terms for us to use. They're good terms. We use them all the time. That's, what's that? Oh, an AP. Very good. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. But if you look at the climate history of the Great Plains, it wasn't just the 30s where these kind of drought and dust bowl conditions existed. This list just kind of shows how it's a cycle of about every 15 years between boom, good years, drought, and of course a lot of people like my dad still say drought, okay, if they're from various parts of the plains and things. There were grasshopper infestations, huge blizzards, boom times when a lot of immigrants moved to the region thinking it was so great that the rain was going to be good, and then again a drought would come later, until 2013, which was actually a worse drought a year than 1936 at the height of the Great Depression and the Dirty 30s. So to combat that, of course, the iconic windmill was developed and perfected around the Great Plains to bring up water. And then there were other ways of having kind of scientific research showing how we need to have other ways of making more rain, since windmills weren't bringing enough water and we needed more rain. So scientific research really was based on this idea that rain will follow the plow, as you've heard before. But it wasn't just that. It was kind of a biblical concept that God would honor those people making the desert to bloom and honoring his work by tilling the land. And also that the plowing itself would bring evaporation up into the air and cause it to rain more. When that didn't happen, there were people called cloud crackers. And they based their ideas on that they were looking at how even during the Napoleonic Wars in Europe and the U.S. Civil War, when there was a lot of chemical and gunpowder explosions going off, that actually some of those years of war that caused there was more rainfall. Therefore, it was caused by chemical. So these rainmakers were borrowing some of those ideas from that area, including the Steiger vortex rainmaking cannon. Here's a group of people in Nebraska who thought it would work to make that rain over their crops in western Nebraska. Those did not work, so they were related to their churches and big prayer sessions and prayer circles out in the fields, which they were still doing in the 2000s, and Wing, North Dakota made the news when they were having a prayer circle calling for more rain and special sessions at church. When that didn't work, more forests were planted. They plant more trees was the idea to do that, and there was a Baptist minister in Nebraska who really believed that if you plant trees, evaporation will go up, causing more rain, of course. So shelter belts and all kinds of exotic species like catawba were brought into the southern plains, and pine and conifers were brought in, including the Nebraska National Forest, which is still there today. The Kansas National Forest didn't make it over by Garden City. It wasn't going to. But there's still remnants of this in Nebraska. The Great Plains in the south here should look like this. This is during a land run in 1889 here in this county, Cleveland County, where you can see that there were only a few trees along ditch lines and creeks. Nowhere really else. There wasn't this widespread tree. Trees are in many ways the enemy of the prairie. American Indians used fire to suppress brush and forbs and trees to be here because it was bad for bison. Now they're showing that it's just really along creek backs where the trees were. But nonetheless, if you plant more of them, they thought it would really help bring more rain. When that didn't work, there were artificial rain-making companies that evolved. Hot air balloons were sometimes used, like the ones shown here that were going to add more chemicals up into the clouds. They use explosives to blast chemicals into the atmosphere. And the idea of even shooting magnetized sand into the clouds then would help it produce rain. One of the biggest proponents of this was C.W. Post. Yes, the same cereal producer, Post cereals that we know. He wanted more grain, which meant more rain right on Texas where he was from. He had these things called rain battles where he even tried tying dynamite on kites to go up into there. Didn't work. He thought, well, then let's go to a higher place like in the Caprock country in the Texas Panhandle. Again, using explosive. It was very dangerous and bad for a lot of different things. But it's interesting the connection here between industry and environment. Charles Hatfield in Southern California, not in the southern plains here, but whose ideas sometimes were emulated, believed in pluviculture. Okay, in other words, this kind of secret mixture of 23 chemicals in large evaporating tanks set next to reservoirs to help make it rain. And as you could probably read more about in Cynthia's book, it worked kind of not a lot of coincidences going on here. It filled a reservoir. The reservoir broke. There was flooding. He was sued. That was El Nino year, all that, right? So they didn't know their science as well as they should have. That's for darn sure. But so nonetheless. In 1912, the year of the Titanic, there was this idea to, well, let's get rid of those icebergs. Let's make the, you know, get rid of that. And so it would help. If we get rid of icebergs, maybe we can have it rain better in the plains. But actually, not all the years were bad. It's important for us to remember this as scholars, as historians, as others. 1915, for example, was the best year ever on the Great Plains until the 1950s for all recorded time. And that was the bumper year. It was the best for crops ever, which meant that they needed a lot more harvesting equipment. And this is something that I write about in a book that I call Bound in Twine, because the harvesting machine of choice was called the binder or the reaper binder. It was a machine that looked like this. It cut the grain stalks, put it up over the platform, and then tied the bundles or the sheaves or the bevels of wheat with twine and then laid them down, and then they were harvested by working crews. Like my dad was on bundle crews in North Dakota, and then brought to thrashing machines where the grain was separated from the chaff. Well, this relied a lot on these, and you can see that sheaf of wheat there. And, of course, the plural of sheaf is sheaves. They were bringing in the sheaves. It's Sunday. Should we sing, Cynthia? We shall come rejoicing, bringing in the sheaves, was what they were doing here, and relied on this commodity of twine, which the fiber to make twine came from Mexico. It's a long story I have written in a book called Bound in Twine. You can look it up later. But in 1915, I have a whole chapter in the book about that year, was because it was a bumper year. The revolution that was going on in Mexico hit the Yucatan Peninsula, where the agave fibers were grown to make this twine for farmers in the North American plains and in Canada. And so it resulted in something called the sisal situation, the sisal fiber that was used. In terms of, so needed was this sisal fiber fiber to make twine for the harvest of this bumper crop year. But Carranza, the leader of the Mexican Revolution, put a blockade on the port, and it wasn't able to go out. And so all the twine manufacturers threatened that we should go to war. This was during the Woodrow Wilson administration. William Jennings Bryan was Secretary of State from Nebraska, a wheat grower himself on his own farm. And so we resorted to gunboat diplomacy, and an ultimatum was sent to Mexico. Either you open the port, or we will attack to get fiber for twine. So good bumper years are important, too. Read more about it in Bound in Twine if you'd like. But nationally, none of these things really work. Railroads promoted it nonetheless. In fact, there was one idea that even suggested this Baptist minister in Nebraska that railroads, the friction on the rails, actually meant more rain would come down too because of the friction and the metals going together. So boosters promoted it, railroads did, nothing worked. People blamed the wind, okay, naturally on the plains. Many did as the Comanches and the Kiowa had always done and picked up and moved. Not all, but many people did. But then the 1930s and the Dust Bowl years. And I want to spend just a couple minutes talking about that, because these iconic photos you're very much aware of, the 1936, Dark Sunday, Black Sunday, all these kind of things that were going on, and how historians study them is also kind of part of the story. People did actually look to God for help again. The old expression in Kansas, ashes to ashes and dust to dust. The men folk raved and the women cussed. Take it or leave it, in God we trust. And if they didn't, many did leave, not all. There's not as many left as you thought. Many stuck it out, later accepted government help during the New Deal, although many fought that too, but nonetheless. There were other issues too, like this 1935 design to pump water out of lakes and creeks, then kind of shoot it back up into the atmosphere to make it rain. Obviously didn't work. But how historians have looked at the Dust Bowl as part of the story I'd like to just mention today. One of the people I worked with at the University of Kansas, Donald Worster, in 1979 published his book, Dust Bowl, the Southern Plains in the 1930s. The exact same year, a professor over here at Panhandle State in Goodwell, Oklahoma, Paul Bonifield, wrote his book, The Dust Bowl, Men, Dirt, and Depression. Both the same year, completely different understandings, completely different interpretations. And Bill Cronin at University of Wisconsin wrote a great essay comparing these two books and how historians tell stories and interpret the past. Donald Worster took the disposition that the Great Depression, the Dust Bowls, were caused by the Great Plow-Up, when prices were so high during the 19-teens, during World War I, wheat will win the war, food will win the war, all kinds of farmers moved to the Great Plains, did the Great Plow-Up, caused more dust, that then when the drought cycle hit, caused these Great Dust Bowls. Others argue, no, that can't really be the case. It was just the weather, natural cycles, wind, drought, things like that. And then another book came out all these have really boring covers, dry, gray. And some of my students will say they're awful dry, Dr. Evans, no pun intended, but that's what they think about some of the readings here. But they could have done better with covers, maybe. But Jeff Kunfer, a scholar who went to Texas and now teaches at University of Saskatchewan, wrote his book On the Great Plains, where he also tackles this notion of Donald Worster saying, no, it wasn't capitalism, it wasn't the Great Plow-Up, it was natural cycles, and really environmental determinism. Later, he's regretted using that term because geographers have very much eschewed that term now. They're trying to leave that notion behind. But nonetheless, they kind of take this different position. Jeff Kunfer's new methodology was using GIS, and he had these great concentric circles that he'll show you where dust bowls happened in the 1880s, the 1890s, and fair enough, there were. It wasn't unique to the 1930s, but his research stops when he gets before the dirty 30s. So I would argue those concentric circles would be much larger in scope if he showed going into the 30s, and then we have to go back to that question, why? And Donald Worster and others would suggest that it was capitalism, was the Great Plow-Up. And that's not to blame farmers. It's not to blame my ancestors who were in the farmers in the Great Plains. If I was a farmer, then I would want to too. Prices were great. You could get good money for a bushel of wheat during those years, especially rebuilding Europe and things. So it's not their fault, it's just what happened. So different interpretations, historians have fun too. But naturally, the bigger part of the New Deal then was to make dams, okay? This was the era of big dams like Hoover Dam, Nevada, Grand Coulee Dam in Washington, to have that steady supply of water so you wouldn't have to rely on rain. Here in Oklahoma, all of these lakes, not a one of them is natural. They're only reservoirs from dams. Not a one natural lake in the state from this. And the one out here in the Panhandle, Optima Dam, is completely dry. It was a boondoggle, a waste of a lot of taxpayers' monies. Some of these, like the one near Altus, others around the state. And then in the 50s, too, sometimes called the filthy 50s, there was another drought period every 15 or 20 years or so. This guy in New England, Wilhelm Reich, invented his cloud buster where he wanted to shoot again chemicals up into the clouds. There was even ideas of atomizing the Arctic, always going back to that idea, right? And even shipping water from northern Canada down to San Diego for the droughty things there. But then, of course, it was more, let's go down. Instead of going up, let's go down. And the Southern Plains sits over the Ogallala Aquifer. You can see from this map the states that it covers and how it is. It's not really a lake underground. It's filtered with sandy areas in between, but you can still pump it out. And that's, of course, what farmers learned to do. And, of course, that meant irrigation in places like this. The development of center pivot and the center pivot round circles that you see as all part of the flyover states, and I'm proud to live in a flyover state like Jason Aldean sings about, and the idea that this was going to then be the salvation for water, except it brought in different kind of crops that weren't native to that area and caused a lot of energy to be used. And then those corners of the fields that don't sit where the circles are, they would grow other crops like milo and sorghum, things that require less water. And of course, it's back in the news, as all you journalists know today, because of the Keystone Pipeline that might be crossing over then. That's a different story, but it comes again. And so there are lessons to be learned from the past that we historians can offer in this, and I appreciate the chance to share a couple of those ideas with you.
I've got a question for you, Sterling. We had a great session called Mega Drought that had a paleoclimatologist, the Oklahoma's climatologist Gary McManus, and other scientists. The Oklahoma State climatologist Gary McManus said that Oklahoma is now home to a whole generation of people who grew up with an abundance of water. These droughts are a shock to the system. The lessons of the 1930s and 50s are completely out of memory. And he feels that this is a huge problem, that even people who live here really don't have a memory of the 30s and the 50s, much less the 1890s. And I wondered if you agreed with that or what you think about that lack of connection we have with our own environmental history.
No, of course, and that's true. That's why history classes are important. That's why we try to, have those things. U.S. history is still required, at least in one section of that, as universities around the state. It's true. Age thing is definitely those like of my parents' age and grandparents and things like that would have better memory of that than others. But no, it's true. And we expect technology to solve those kind of things more,
right?
Because we can have drill the aquifer. Then about 10 years ago, we thought the aquifer was growing dry, but then we learned it really wasn't. So we went back to pumping a lot, and so it goes back and forth. But certainly, thank you.
Bruce Johansson is a professor of communication and Native American studies at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. For you magazine people, he teaches magazine writing, among many other things. But he specializes in the Native people of North America, climate change, and their intersection. I will say that Bruce is the most prolific writer I've ever met. He is the author of 44 books, including the forthcoming Resource Exploitation in Native North America. And the following year, he'll come out with Empty Cellars, Melting Ice and Burning Tundra, Climate Change and Native American Peoples in the United States and Canada. And SEJers will be particularly excited that Bruce has a special interest in greenwashing. And I've been reading this terrific book of his about greenwashing because I devote greenwashing to my 1 week of greenwashing in my environmental journalism class, and there's great stuff in here for anyone who teaches. So Bruce, thank you so much for being with us, and I'll invite you up now. Would you like it in there, or would you like to hold it?
Is it okay if I...
Yes, absolutely.
Walk around?
Yes.
Okay. It's an honor, of course, to be here, and it's very, very nice to see hundreds of people on an environmental issues. Hundreds of people who are taking these signature issues seriously. And it took me back to 1973. I mean, I was working at the Seattle Times, and they put me on the environment beat for the first time ever. And I started doing such things as asking, I mean, how it is that we celebrate, you know, Earth Day, at the same time as soaking Vietnam and, you know, napalm. I also did a series on what could happen in the closed orders of a Puget Sound if we had an oil spill. There are tankers and oil refineries at Cherry Point. This was a few years before the Exxon Valdez happened, and a few decades before the, you know, happened in the Gulf. And the oil companies exploded in anger, and they came in and put the, you know, heat on and asked that I be taken off the beat. And the publisher caved in. This was a while ago. This city editor called me in one day, and he said, "We hear that you like the outdoors. We're gonna put your ass on the ag beat." Took me off the beat. At that point, I started to, you know, work my way off the Times. But I've followed these themes, and in the 90s, I started my first work in climate change, and I needed some scientists to, you know, to look, I mean, over what I was doing. So I made a cold call to Jim Hansen. At the Goddard I mean Institute, and he called me back. And I asked myself, and I asked him, how come you, I mean, this august guy, I'm sure you're busy, how come you called me? And he said, you're from, I mean, Omaha. He said, I mean, I'm from Denison in Iowa. And he said, welcome to my lab. And so, I mean, he's been educating me ever since. And he's taught me to appreciate the science. And I read all kinds of things. I read voraciously to make books, of course, and other things. I read a great deal about, you know, this side thinks this, the horse race that, you know, I mean, Inhofe thinks something, you know, and I really wanted to see Senator Inhofe stand before, you know, this group and defend his idiocy. As a college professor, I can profess. And if you look that up, it means take a stand on an argument. It's something I couldn't do as a journalist. I like it. Anyway, Jim Hansen taught me to, you know, look at certain terms which are kind of in the background all the time, but they sometimes don't get explained, and I don't see them often in the press. You know, the words that we have, you know, that we see but don't explain, don't think about all that much. And if, I mean, I could step aside here. Who here knows what a sooner was? We do have some hands. What or who was a sooner?
They were the people who came for the 1889 land rush, but came earlier than they were legally allowed.
They were soon, see, they were too soon. You know, they basically were squatters. Okay. Anyway, the other theme which I go into all the time in climate, which I don't see discussed much at all, and it's crucial, is thermal inertia. Can anybody help me out? What is it? Anytime I bring this up, the editors roll their eyes. Seth, what is it, Seth?
You're talking about the climate change has already been committed from past CO2.
Right.
In other words, no matter what we do now, we're committed to X amount of warming through thermal inertia.
How much time, see, the emissions that we have today don't, I mean, equal heat now. It takes about 50 years in the air and about an average, say, 100 to 200 in the oceans to express as heat and to melt ice and to show the results of the CO2 that's being, you know, CO2, you know, I mean, and others, which are being put into the air now. What this means is that the weather that we see today is an expression of the atmosphere about 1965, roughly. Okay, the emissions in 1965 were much lower than they are now. What this means is, I mean, all of us react to what we feel on our skin now. You know, the hot air, cold air, whatever it is. We react to what's affecting us now. Our diplomacy tends to react in the past tense. I mean, first it, the politicians and the, you know, diplomats are reacting in the past tense, while the atmosphere is reacting in the future tense. Now, this is important, and the scientists who understand this, this is one reason why they're ringing the bell, is that they understand that you can actually forecast backwards. You know, I mean, we can look at the emissions now and forecast how it'll be in, you know, down the road. How high is the CO2 in the atmosphere right now? Figure, yeah.
It's in around
402 or so parts per what?
Million.
Right. Now, what was the last time it was that high? How long has it been? Not quite that far, but still a long time. 2 to 3 billion years, you know, the Pliocene. Now, how much higher were the oceans back then than they are now? Approximately 100 feet higher. How higher was the? How much higher was the temperature than now? Yeah, you know, 4 to 6 Fahrenheit. How come the oceans aren't that much higher and the temperature isn't all that much hotter now?
Inertia.
It takes that much time for the atmosphere and the oceans to express the result. Now, the cake is being baked. Our cake is being baked as we speak. Now, this is what the skeptics, or whatever you want to call them, don't get. You know, Inhofe, I think, was the guy who brought the snowball in on the, you know, well, you know, Washington, D.C., hey, it snowed. Gee whiz. I mean, Omaha still gets cold some of the time. Whoop-de-doo. Inertia is a very important concept. And anytime I bring this up, I mean, I make cold calls on editors, they roll their eyes. Thermal inertia. Uh-oh, here it comes. It's important because we know what the is going to get us. I mean, it's not complicated, actually. But there's a great deal of fog on this issue. People, there's all these arguments, and on one hand, on the other, and certain people being paid by other folks to say certain things, but not that directly. Some of the time, I mean, I ask myself, does Inhofe actually believe this stuff? And maybe he does. I don't know. I would really like to hear him defend it, you know, under scrutiny, because to me, what he says makes no sense. So in the time I have, I just wanted to make that point. I hope we'll be able to get Dan up high tech. There's still some good things about going face to face. No passwords, no usernames, no, hooray. I mean, I have a class which we've just set up called InfoLit. And what we're doing is we're getting students into the common conversation on important issues, including the issues that concern folks here. And I've been surprised at how tuned in they actually can get, because we set this course up out of the fear that all the Facebooking and all that stuff was getting people onto their own little islands, especially young people. Our text is the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. That's our textbooks. And each student is responsible each day to bring a story and discuss it. And then they get a reward from me, which is a coyote stamp on a folded over sheet of scrap paper. It works amazingly well. I mean, I come to class, I say, students, what's hot? All the hands go up. Amazing. After 32 years, I can all teach this old dog some new tricks. Anyway, if we don't get Dan up, just to tease, then I can stop now, okay.
Bruce, thank you so much. Thank you. But Bruce, the real question is, did you bring us a coyote sticker for listening? Dan, can you hear me?
I sure can.
Oh, this is wonderful. Yay. Yeah.
Well, I much prefer the face-to-face, as Bruce was talking about, but this is a nice way to at least keep my carbon footprint smaller.
Yes, yes. We actually appreciate that, Dan. So let me quickly introduce you. This is Dan Wildcat. He is Dean of the College of Natural and Social Sciences at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, and founding director of the Haskell Environmental Research Studies Center there. He is a member of Oklahoma's Muskogee Nation tribe, and his many, many initiatives for Native people and climate change include the American Indian and Alaska Native Climate Change Working Group, video series, and books, including his most recent, which is Red Alert, Saving the Planet with Indigenous Knowledge. Dan, we are so glad that this technology worked out. It's great to have you. So go ahead. We can see you beautifully.
Okay, well, I'm really glad to present my virtual self this morning, and I will clarify a couple of things. Believe it or not, I was liberated from the deanship about 2 years ago, stepped down from that, so now I've returned, thankfully, to full-time teaching and overseeing grants and that kind of thing. And in fact, I believe it's now, we're going back 2.5 years ago at the University of Oklahoma, at the National Weather Center, we changed the name from the American Indian and Alaska Native Climate Change Working Group to the Indigenous Peoples Climate Change Working Group. Long story about that, but the short version is our Pacific Island relatives invited some of us who were working on the National Climate Assessment report to come to their home. So we were invited to the Big Island, and after that invitation, we knew, well, these people need to be a part of this whole experiment in chaos theory and complex adaptive systems, which is the working group. And so we just shortened it, the Indigenous Peoples Climate Change Working Group. And you are all invited. We would love to have great journalistic representation at our fall meeting, which will be in New Orleans in November 5th, 6th, and 7th. And we went there specifically because we're keenly aware of the really crisis, the imminent crisis that those tribes on the Gulf Coast are facing right now. And we wanted to kind of come to their backyard while they still have one, because some of them are really examining how they might remain, what would that look like, and some are contemplating what removal will mean. So anyway, it's going to be an interesting meeting. Go to our Facebook page, Indigenous Peoples Climate Change Working Group Facebook page, and you can get a link to some of the information about that upcoming meeting. But you're all invited. Anyway, okay, so let me kind of focus on the Midwest. I think I'll make some just preliminary remarks specific to the Midwest and then kind of chime in on some of the issues, great issues, that Bruce raised. Number one, I think the primary challenge we face today throughout the United States, and it's no different in the Midwest, although we do have some sort of insurance against this because of our heavy agricultural investment throughout the Great Plains. But I think that if you almost have to not be paying attention to recognize that we are seeing now very clearly the consequence of this 200 years of really intense adding of carbon to the atmosphere. So let me quickly go over sort of the way these things are related and what people, if they're paying attention, should be noticing. The first thing, and I'm very mindful of this given where you're sitting, no one has to talk to people in the Norman area there about extreme weather events. I think in general, one of the most frightening things that we see in the Great Plains is we see the issue of increased numbers of extreme weather events. In fact, tornadic activity is something you grew up and you're used to, particularly myself growing up in northeastern Oklahoma and southeastern Kansas. You're used to tornadic events, but it really catches your attention when you increasingly are confronting not just, one tornado, but when you see virtual walls of tornadoes, and they're not F2s, they're not F3s, but we're talking about F4 and F5 events. These things are catastrophic to communities. I mean, we've seen it in the Andover region in Kansas. We've seen it in Joplin, Missouri. We've certainly seen it right where you're sitting in Oklahoma. And I think this is likely to be something that people should be really paying attention to. And of course, the cost of these things is devastating. to communities, not just to the, you know, economic kind of notions of a foundation for a community, but the social fabric of the communities and how it affects people, of course, is very disproportionately distributed according to one's socioeconomic activity, because some people can afford to rebuild, some people have no resources to rebuild. So I think extreme weather events really calls into question something that we need to be very mindful of. Associated with that, you know, I mean, I think the studies now that are looking at the effect of soil erosion with these the kinds of heavier rainfall events that we might have, the fact that we have in much of the plains reduced amounts of rainfall, or even more importantly, when it comes, is greatly impacted by the changes that we're seeing in climate. In other words, you know, you can still have the same amount of annual rainfall, but it sure makes a difference if that rainfall is not coming, you know, fairly widely distributed over, you know, a 12-month calendar, as opposed to seeing tremendous large amounts coming at one time, and then what that means in terms of soil erosion. And of course, when we're looking at ag soil erosion and we look at our rivers and creeks and our riparian systems, our lakes, you know, we've got a major problem in Kansas now with the silt that's building up in Army Corps of Engineers built lakes, and of course the runoff that goes into rivers and creeks makes the fish that remain in those places inedible. That's how serious, you know, the water contamination issues are. Some of you will remember maybe from the press, I think we're going back maybe 10, 15 years now, Kansas was, unfortunately, the Kansas River was made that top 10 list of the most polluted rivers. And everyone is going, Kansas? How can that be Kansas? Because, you know, we think of pollution with industrial manufacturing, and it's because in the minds of most people, they don't recognize that ag business in the United States, large agricultural activities, are in fact industrial manufacturing. I always like Wes Jackson's comment about ag in the Central Plains, and that is, you know, what we have is we have a dying patient, and the patient is only able to live through massive doses of chemotherapy and the constant administration of an artificial life support system. And in the face of that and the drawdown on waters of the Ogallala Aquifer, we had just this last year, some of you will remember this, we had a Kansas State Senator in the Kansas Senate who was proposing with some of his colleagues to literally build a canal from the Missouri River to western Kansas, where they were going to create a giant, you know, lagoon to basically a man-made lake, really to keep the water supply going out there as the Ogallala Aquifer is depleted. So people are coming up with you know, really strange notions, and they see the problem, but they seem unable to recognize that, you know, we have to take actions very immediately. So I think when you look at land issues, soil erosion, when you look at extreme weather events, of course, I didn't say anything about the air quality issues associated with the soil erosion, long periods without rain. You know, some people are projecting a future, a return of a Dust Bowl, Oklahoma and Kansas, if we have extended periods of drought. And I think, you know, when we think of even disease now and challenges we face with public health, so It's been really interesting watching all the reports this past month about the oak mites. So we had an oak mite epidemic here in northeastern Oklahoma, and it was discovered because students at all the colleges here in northeastern Kansas were coming in complaining they had these rashes, and you know, some were suspicious they might have bed bugs in their dorms, and the doctors quickly identified that these were oak mites. And so the question got raised, you know, God, we've always had, people would say, we've always had oak mites. What's the epidemic? Well, it has to do this year, particularly in northeastern Oklahoma and all through eastern Kansas, the fact that we had a somewhat milder and wetter summer than what we're used to, and some milder winters. So this combination of the wetter and milder summers seems to have contributed to, this growth and oak mite population, plus the fact that the milder winter, just like the pine bark beetle, may be leading to more success in overwintering for the oak mite. In other words, the milder winters and stuff allow more of those oak mites in their reproductive cycles to exist beneath the bark of the trees. So, all these things are related in fascinating ways. Haven't said anything really about invasive species, although, it's almost ludicrous to think that people aren't taking some sort of serious thought to the fact that, when I grew up in northeastern Oklahoma, when I grew up in southeastern Kansas, this would be, the 50s and the 60s, people had absolutely no local knowledge of armadillos. Well, guess what? You have local knowledge of armadillos now. My cousin, Bunky Echo Hawk, Pawnee, was talking about, the disturbing, scenes of some of our relatives down there around Pawnee, Oklahoma, when they were discovering, that they had armadillos rooting around and some of them trying to live under porches and things. When those animals have been around a long time. I don't know if you've taken a good look at an armadillo, but they're about as dinosaur-like as you can find. And when they're moving to where they're going to identify their habitat, their home, we should be paying attention. They might be telling us something about what's going on overall with the climate. So I think there's a lot that is going on. It's happening. And the implications, for ag, for quality of life with severe weather events, for all of us who call the Great Plains, particularly the southern and central Great Plains home. I guess I should even modify that. I have a lot of students teaching at Haskell Indian Nations University. I work with students from all over the contiguous 48 states in Alaska. And their stories they are telling me are just, we see them on the national news, but it might not register to people. So, when you've had two tornadoes in a two-week period, in the late summer in central Wisconsin, where one of my students, an Oneida student, sent me an email and said, "Dr. Wildcat, what's going on? I don't even ever remember." This was a young woman who was, 25, 26 years old. So I never remember, I don't even remember having tornadoes here. Well, tornadoes, these tornadic events are more likely to be seen in South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, places where you thought of Tornado Alley as something that distinctly ran, across the southern and the south central plains. Well, maybe not so more anymore. The tornado alley has been broadened. We're going to get eight-lane superhighway here going from west to east. So I think there's a lot that we should be paying attention to. Three quick points, and then I'll end, and I hope we have time for questions, but three quick points. The main problem we have today is the way people live. One, they live in a sort of boxes of insulated ignorance. Very few people experience the weather because they're moving constantly from one environment to the other where they've insulated themselves. We literally have insulated ourselves into ignorance, a kind of ignorance and awareness about what's going on in our backyards that our ancestors couldn't have imagined. The second thing is we have a population that's extremely geographically mobile. One of the reasons I emphasize the absolute importance of listening to what native indigenous people have to say about the world we share with them is that they have intergenerational transmissions of deep knowledge, deep spatially based knowledge about what has happened. We live in a society where they're telling us today many college students will move six times in their lifetime to advance their careers and in their work lives. It's hard to know anything about a place if you're constantly picking up and moving. Where's your benchmark to have any sense of change over the longer periods of time? So indigenous people must be listened to. Most importantly, I think we have this kind of culture that we're a part of, and certainly this technology plays a part in this. But I think that to go back to a great point that Bruce made, it's time for all of us to take a stand. And to take a stand, you have to be some place. And I think there's going to be a great demand, a great necessity, let's say, for people to take a stand and begin to really take some serious consideration of the places they call home and not think of that as merely a zip code, an area code, a postal address, or a Facebook home page. Native people represent cultures that were literally emergent out of tens of thousands of years of a symbiotic relationship between peoples and place. We need to listen to their voices. We need to grasp the wisdom that they hold. And I think it's not a question of looking to the past. It's a question of paying attention right now and drawing on some of the keen insights that we might draw from those indigenous intellectual traditions to address the problems we're facing today. So thank you very much for the invitation. I'm glad we were able to make this work.
Dan, thank you so much. I know you can hear me. I don't know if you can hear the big round of applause you're getting. I've got a quick follow-up question for Dan, and raise your hand if you've got a follow-up question for Dan in case the clock is going to strike midnight and we're going to lose him. Dan, at our open plenary, Kathleen Tierney of the National Hazards Center at the University of Colorado was telling us about the social vulnerability, the vulnerability of the poor and disenfranchised to disasters, and she said that the 1% is always going to be able to adapt. But we were talking about that, and we were wondering if that's really true in a climate-changed future. Will it really be only the 1% who is able to adapt? How do you look at that statement?
Well, I think that's worth discussing because I'm not sure I would completely agree with that. I think that everyone will be impacted, but as I said, certainly the negative effects of this, the very harsh negative, almost existential consequences of what we're going to face, are going to be disproportionately felt by the poor and the 99%. I think that probably, it's that question of how well can people insulate themselves? And I think that, adaptation to what, for what, The thing that I would challenge everyone to think about, and I think journalists are going to have such an incredible role as we try to change the dialogue, I would argue that those people are not adapting. They are insulating themselves. They are impoverishing themselves because what kind of existence can humankind have or can a human being have if you shut yourself off or try to close yourself off from the balance of, you know, the life world, this beautiful blue-green planet that's that supports us. I understand some people are signing up to take those spaceships to Mars now, you know, and those would be the 1%, you know. And maybe that's what we ought to do. We ought to all put in a major fund to send the 1% to Mars. A GoFundMe site, and you know, hey, let's send the top 1% to Mars. I'm all for it.
Love it. Does anyone else have a question for Dan before we lose him? Well, Dan, it was so wonderful to have you here. I'm so glad you could be here virtually. Yeah, thank you. Now, Jay has some things to tell us, but first we would have time for one or two questions for Sterling or Bruce. Yes, let me hand you the microphone.
Yeah, Marsha Johnston, freelancer. Just for Sterling, I believe you made reference to the idea that the Oglala was being depleted, but then you said it wasn't, and that was news to me. So,
well, it goes back and forth. Certainly, it is being depleted very fast, especially because of center pivot in the western Kansas, western Oklahoma region, western breast of the Sand Hills, especially bad, where they're growing row crops where they should be. It should just be grazing land for cattle. And it was good grazing land, it was great. So then it was discovered a few years ago that, oh, it wasn't being depleted as fast as they thought. There were some other kind of hydrographers that we got involved, and geologists and that, who were looking at the aquifer system. But then, of course, now it's being drained again. So, but again, that little information gave fuel to the naysayers. That, you know, tech solves, we don't have a problem, we should just throw more energy, which takes a lot of fuel to run center pivot. So, but it goes back and forth like that. No, it is being completed.
Well, that's the interesting lesson of what you talked about, is that there really is no new stories, you know? Even with climate change, we're sort of repeating the same mistakes on relying on technology instead of, you know, caring for the land and water in the first place. That's kind of, you know, the story of our relationship with the environment. Yes, Seth has a question. I think this is going to be our last question, and then Jay will give us some directions.
Seth Borenstein, AP. Sterling, for you, you talked about going back to the Dust Bowl causes and the different theories. I was under the impression that no one really, lately has any doubts that plowing had anything to do with. Can you explain? It doesn't sound like you agree with it, but what is the theory that it has nothing to do with it? What's it based on?
Yeah, and especially I would encourage you to read it. Jeff Kunfer's book.
It's a good question, Seth. Thank you. It goes back and forth to way back to James Malin at Kansas and Grasslands Ecology, and he was a naysayer of the New Deal, and therefore it was only weather-related and things like that. The New Deal could not come in and help. It was only weather-related. Whereas others like Don Worster and others are saying, well, no, obviously it is the great play. It is capitalism at work here. And again, not to cite farmers, no one exactly is, but the system, the economy, right, that was doing that. Then along comes other people like Bonifield, like Hurt at Purdue, and especially Jeff Kunfer at Saskatchewan, who's a very good friend of mine. We've been on many panels. He's a great scholar, lots of great issues that he's done. But he is of this belief, looking at GIS, that there's always been dust storms. Therefore, but he doesn't take it that there weren't as bad as the 1930s. Read his book on the Great Plains if you want more about it, and that's what I would encourage you to do. But, and I've had Don Worster and Jeff Kunfer at the panels at the one in Tallahassee one time, an environmental history conference. It was a great time. A big room of people wanted to see what was going to happen with that. And the majority still, the far 100% majority, were still with Don Worster and the idea of capitalism and things. But it was interesting to see what he had to say, and he's a great guy, and I encourage you to read it.
So join me in thanking Sterling and Bruce. Yes. Thank you so much for being with us. It was great.